Right. So we were thinking about this responsiveness at the last stop that we had together, responding to things, other people, breeds of dogs, the timber, the terroir of the wine, whatever that might be, right? Of, you know, this kind of space for a unique engagement that might crop up from that in various ways. And so we can ask ourselves, oh, hey, girl, you know, what are the possibilities within this? And how well have I realized those possibilities or helped those possibilities to become realized? And then I had asked us the question, you know, there's a question about responsibility that this raises. I'm going to come into this a little bit via Aristotle, because he's still pretty good. right. You know, Aristotle tells us what I think is kind of common sense at a certain level, that, you know, in order to be appropriately praised or blamed for anything at all, where praise can mean, you know, that's excellent, that's fine, that's noble, that's well done, right? Blame, censure in a general way, not necessarily speaking to, like, you know, badness or evilness, though it might sometimes, but just as a, that's not excellent, that falls short of being fine or noble or whatever that might be, to whatever degree. In order to have room for praise and blame, to even begin to be appropriate, to even think about praising and blaming, we need to be responsible for the action that's getting praise or blame. And intuitively, they're like, oh yeah, if I'm not responsible for it, why would you blame me for that? And we see it with, we're happy to take praise sometimes. It's not responsible, maybe. But that praise and blame require responsibility.
So just along that line.
Can you speak up?
Yeah, sorry. Just along those lines of, we have to be responsible for whichever direction that's going. Picking up on something that Dennis and a couple of others mentioned in the first about sort of the effort put into.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about sometimes when you come across a naturally talented athlete, right? And then one who perhaps has to put a bit more work in to achieve those same sort of results. Would the one that has the effort be considered more excellent in that than the one who doesn't?
Have we all heard Marisa's question? All right.
That's a tough one.
Not that you have to have an answer.
I'm hearing people mutter, that's a tough one. Yeah. And I'm echoing that.
And I was thinking exactly the same thing in high school. I was in a swim team, and there was one girl who was just naturally, just won everything. and the coach was always so disgusted with her because she never worked. She just got to pool and won the breaststroke. And to me, that wasn't excellent.
Ah. Yeah, so good.
So we equate excellence with the amount of effort in a lot of times.
But then I think that's where jealousy and also envy pop up. because I've been in a situation before where, like, sometimes people are threatened by your natural talent and they hate you for it, right? Mm-hmm. Not because...
Yeah.
And maybe you do put in some work for it, but... Yeah. If you're, you know, naturally inclined and somebody hates you for that, I'm not sure that has anything to do with, like... yeah, I guess there's almost like this Puritan, oh, you gotta work for it mentality.
There is something a little puritanical in some instances of this, right? And just because the Puritans said it doesn't automatically mean it's wrong. It makes me suspicious. It doesn't automatically... A broken clock twice a day.
I'm actually wondering, sorry, as this has sort of unfolded, the idea about sort of putting one's, not just effort and work, but also the sort of heart and soul into it.
I'm thinking
about when I coached basketball, I had a similar situation where one of the girls on the team was... just unbelievably naturally talented and also a horrible athlete in the sense that she didn't show up, her work ethic was horrible, she was not a good team player, but man,
So pause there for a second if I can.
Sure.
That bit about she was not a team player, that's a place where as a basketball player she is not excellent.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right? Exactly. Because an excellent basketball player entails necessarily working with a team of other basketball players to pass the ball, to block for one another, to set somebody up with a shot, right? You've in the same way that, you know, one might be able to make all kinds of sounds on an oboe or a violin, but unless you're willing to play at the same tempo with the rest of the orchestra and in the same emotional resonance as the rest of the orchestra, and to step back and exchange the solo parts with one another, you've actually fallen short in your musicianship. Mm-hmm. Likewise, I would just say she straight up fell short in her basketball playerhood if she was not playing with her teammates. I'm just going to kind of grab that little thread here.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you on that one. That made me more just as an athlete in...
Yeah.
Okay, and so then I'm also thinking of the students who struggled more on... Yeah. They didn't come as naturally, but man, she had the heart of an athlete. She worked. She showed up at any day.
Yeah.
I would want to play her more than the one that just wins the game, because that to me was excellence in that striving.
Okay. And so there's this idea that, you know, I think this suggests to us, and we can, you know, swing in some other directions as well, you know, the point of good basketball is not just to win the game, right? It's to play a beautiful game, striving to win. Maybe. Or something in that vein. The goal of scoring more points than the other team has to be present to make it basketball, and not just like throwing a ball around. And the aim has to be there to direct the activity.
The ends do not justify the means.
But the way in which we pursue that end also constitutes the activity.
And that's the way, to me, is to push yourself. The difference between your two girls was one was going as far as she could go, and the other was just like letting it happen. And to me, there's a need for, even in a speech day for me with my kids, I know when I have been excellent, and it's when I have really pushed it, whatever it may be, as opposed to it still could be good, but I didn't push.
So let's maybe see if we can put some meat on these bones a little bit, because this is really interesting, these two pieces that we're getting together. So I kind of put this back around and say, now what if that very naturally talented young woman also was pushing herself as far as she could go, also was striving for more, right?
Yeah.
Now, like, we would hold her up as a model for her teammates and for others in various ways. So I think that there's a distinction to be, you know, maybe by way of a different joke, right? So we all know the line from Garrison Keillor, Like Woebegone, where all the children are above average, right? And that too is a ridiculous line that we laugh at. But I think it's ridiculous in some illuminating ways, right? In that, you know, above average just implies that we're comparing ourselves to each other.
Okay.
And not everyone can be above average in that sense. But, because if the whole sea went up, all the ships would be higher, but they'd still be on the same level as each other. So no one would still be above average at that point. Or we, you know, the average wouldn't change. Just the, you know, they're, you know, we can't all be above average. However, we can all be excellent, perhaps, in a different mode, where what we're doing is not comparing myself to another human in the same thing. Am I making more three-point shots than Marisa is? And so I'm above average, and that's good enough. But rather, are we all excelling at the goals of basketball? Right? Are we all excelling in our fitness, in our athleticism? Are we all playing basketball well? or making music well or whatever, right?
So it's almost like you're turning it into relativism. Maybe there's both, like relative and objective excellence.
I think I'm doing just the opposite of relativism. I'm suggesting that what we are comparing ourselves to is a goal that's in the activity and not the performance of other actors, right? So in the sense that, you know, if other artists were to carve statues as magnificently as Michelangelo did, that wouldn't make him a worse artist. Even though he was now closer to average, it would just mean the world had more excellent sculptors in it. Because the standards of sculpture are in the marble. They're not in the other humans. And in the marble, loosely, like it's more than just the literal block of marble, right? But there's a sense in which Michelangelo's making an amazingly moving and brilliant statue does not stop anyone else, in principle, from also making an amazingly moving and brilliant work of art, right? The standards are in the activity. Or think about the way that in an orchestra, right, the players actually really do lift one another when they're all playing well. When everybody's on, we're all doing our personal best that day, more than we would if we were playing with like mediocre players who were having a rough day, who were whatever, right? We see obviously excellence begetting more excellence. So it's not that, you know, the first violin needs to be better than the second and third violin. It's that all the violins need to be awesome. Right? And so they can still fall short in various ways. But the standard is not, am I better than her? The standard is, am I making beautiful music? Right? Which is just, and so what the outstanding athlete or the outstanding musician might do, among other things, is not to serve as a basis of comparison in his own right, but to point us toward the end that is there to be revealed in the activity itself. And now we're back to responsiveness.
You know, one thing that I keep, through all of this, I keep falling back to the example you gave about Henry Ford's employees. You know, hiring all these carriage makers and 9 out of 10 I'm putting in disgust because the work was not up to their excellence.
Yeah.
And it made me think about to what extent is excellence to be a shared thing for society. Huh. And long term, a villain like Henry Ford to lessen it for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, pay him more money and he'll do it. But was society more excellent when everybody, all these craftsmen making carriages and all these very capable carriage users handling their life, their horses and everything else, and doing what to do, you know, doing it excellently? Were they better off, or are we better off now where all you got to do is, you know, turn the ignition and go?
Yeah.
Everything is so much easier for everybody because of Henry Ford, I suppose. I won't look at it that way, but
yeah.
But what's the point?
Good.
Yeah, I don't know. I think excellence somehow has to be shared.
Yeah.
By a group, by a society, by a culture, whatever. And if it's not, really, what good is it except for personal satisfaction for a few individuals?
Well, I want to pick apart two pieces of that and maybe focus on the second more than the first, right? So I guess I would just emphasize in the first place, you know, at least for myself, I don't mean to be putting out the idea that, you know, the goods that we're kind of getting a grasp on here are the only goods that are there to be had. and that there might not be trade-offs between incompatible or incommensurable goods. That a certain amount of, you know, a certain amount of convenience, a certain amount of kinds of standard of living, like good health care, plenty of food, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, being able to get places and do things. These are also goods, right? And so the question of how to rank these goods to one another, I would like to let that be a different problem for another day. What I would like to do here is to ask ourselves, here are some particular potential goods that we maybe don't talk about or have or think about as much. I'd like to get clear on what they are, simply as a thing that we, and I'm here I am dangerously tending toward relativism, but that's just because we're not going to finish the conversation today. I think we're setting ourselves up for further conversations if we're doing this well. I want to point us toward some values or some goods or some ideals that we might not be accustomed to thinking about, at least in these terms. I want to have that modest goal, but then I also want to make sure that we get to Dennis's question here about what is it, does it even make sense for me to be excellent alone? Or do I need a community at least, which at least creates space for excellence on the part of most or everyone? And I think that that is very much tied into the idea, into understanding excellence itself. I think we need to solve that problem, or at least get clear on that problem in order to even grasp this phenomenon, even before we can compare it. So I want to make sure that we hit that.
Wanted to go back to your music and, you know, you're talking about the oboes, but I have this distinct memory in choir, and I'm going to share with you the story, and then you guys can let me know what you think. So there's this girl, and she loved to sing. I mean, she loved it.
Yeah.
And she poured her heart into it. Like, she was like that girl that Marissa wants to put on the basketball. It's like she was in quad, you know, trios and quartets, and she gave her life to song and choir, and I hated listening to her sing. She was objectively bad. Objectively bad singer, and she loved it. And you know, maybe collectively in choir she was good, right? Because she could read the music, she could hit the high notes, but the moment you gave her a solo, like, I wanted earplugs. And so what do you do with a situation like that? Because she loved it, she got as good as she could get. And is that relative? Because objectively, she sounded like trash.
Right. So she was not excellent, because the standards come from the activity. Right? So she may have had some other virtue, like diligence or hard work.
Yeah.
But those are not yet musicianship.
But she was rewarded. Like, she got, like, well, part of it was that her aunt was the choir teacher.
Now we have the
getting very cool. She got a solo in every single concert. She got a lead in every single musical. And she loved it.
All right.
Her aunt loved it. Well, her aunt was the same. Like, she was a choir teacher, and she was a terrible, like, solo.
Okay. Thank you for giving us the full story. Because I'm thinking about...
It doesn't mean that she didn't love it.
I don't care about love.
Yeah. She did pour her heart into it.
So I just... Quick counter story to that, if I may, right? When I was living in New Jersey, I ended up, like, a couple of friends and many more acquaintances, because once you get into these little groups, whatever. I knew a bunch of people who were students at Westminster Choir College in New Jersey. Like, one of the excellent musical schools for undergraduates in the United States. Like, really excellent. There were others that are better, but they were good, you know, and they were there to be musicians. And I had, you know, partly through, like, some church singings and various other kinds of groups, I got to know some of these folks. It was an incredible compliment to me when they invited me to sing with them in a supporting role. Because I wasn't going to drag them down in the thing. I never got a solo singing with those kids, nor did I deserve one. And so I'm glad I wouldn't have wanted one. I wouldn't have asked. But that when they were to say, you know, you are good enough to be here, you know, at an ensemble, a small ensemble level, like eight or less kind of folks, you know, with us. because they knew what good musicianship was. And it was because I could see their own excellence, that when they saw something in me, that meant something. As opposed to, like, when your mom says, oh, that was great. That doesn't count for shit. I mean, that means I love you, coming from mom. But it doesn't... Right. Yeah, but that doesn't actually, you know, it means something different coming from mom, right? Or from dad, even, right? Mm-hmm. And there were other people who we knew in these mutual circles who did not get that same invitation because they were not at the same level in terms of their musicianship, in terms of being able to, you know, not, sing the right notes, sing them with expressions, sing them together in ways that blended with the other voices in the ensemble, as opposed to kind of, you know, even if they were technically right, there are those other parts of the art form, the, you know, the feeling that goes into the music, right? So in that case, there's a kind of recognition of what the standards even are at two different levels, right? Like, we can all say, boy, that sounds like crap, when we listen to a really horrible singer or whatever, of whatever kind. But there are also, I would suggest, standards that get revealed to us in the course of advancing in anything at all. Whether that's music or woodworking or basketball or whatever other sorts of things. There are elements of what it even means to do the thing well that you don't understand and you can't understand until you've begun to immerse yourself in it. And it's for that reason, not that you're as good as me, but that someone else who has seen the detail and the rigor of what's involved is in a position to complement my work in a way that an outsider is not. Because they don't know what those things are, because they haven't embodied what those things are. We can say of the kind of the master craftsman or the master musician or whatever that might be, they make it look easy, right? Mm-hmm. And perhaps for them it is easy, whether it started more or less easy or not. But they've gotten to the level, they've worked through the difficulties. Like, I can watch Dennis or a video of somebody or whatever. They're at their workbench with their hand plane. It's like, oh yeah, they're just like pushing a little hand plane across this board. Then I go to my workbench and I actually pick up my own hand plane and I make a mess of this board and I tear out the grain and it's crooked and it's waving and it's doing all of this mess. And then through working through the process of all of the subtle embodied nuances of actually doing that well, then I can look at, once I've accomplished that, then, or once I've even begun to know what's involved, but especially once I've accomplished it, the complement of someone else's work means more. Not because it's compared to, like, being better than mine or as good as mine, but because I know what's involved in doing it well in a way that someone who has never tried doesn't fully know what's involved in doing it well. Like, they don't know it robustly, right?
I mean, that's the object of the 10,000 hours from Malcolm Gladwell, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, to say, you know, it's... Sometimes people will ask, why does the opinion of a film critic carry more weight than just the opinion of the average...
Rotten Tomatoes. .com, right?
Yeah. And the answer that's often given is, you know, the film critic knows much more about film. He or she knows about the history of film and the techniques of creating film and all this knowledge about the art. But then that kind of raises the question, well, it seems like you're trying to derive an ought from an is then. How does correct judgment come out of factual knowledge? Those seem to be two different things.
Ooh. So we might need to back up for a moment, if we're willing, and think about what this knowledge even is, or what it entails, in order to set ourselves up to answer that question. And so, actually, I thought we were going to go here a little more in stop two, actually, than we have so far, which is fine. But that, you know, that idea of responsibility that I kind of initially gestured, or being responsible for the product, doesn't just require that, like, my activity, my agency, my effort brought it about. It also requires intelligibility on the part of the world, or some part of the world, that if there were no kind of regular laws of cause and effect, for instance, I couldn't predict the consequences of my actions, and therefore I couldn't be held responsible for those consequences, even if I chose them. The only way I can be held responsible, praised and blamed for what I've done, is if I could reasonably be expected to know what's going to happen when I act in certain ways, or what's likely to happen. If there's no necessary logical connection between action and result, right, then there's no space, then there's no intelligibility. There's just chaos, there's just randomness at that point. So, you know, the intelligibility is a requirement for choice, for responsibility, for praise and blame, for criticism. So we need to have some intelligibility to the world, or at least the part of the world that's going on, right? And so, you know, that brings us back to, you know, these two different kinds of compliments in a certain way, from the outsider versus the person who's done the 10,000 hours or done the work in whatever way to understand what's involved. Things have revealed themselves in a deeper way. I'm going to speak to music because I just confess that I don't understand film. Like so I'm not going to try to speak to it because I don't understand it. Look at me, epistemic humility, right? but you know, in music, like, we make the jokes in college about, like, why would you take a music appreciation course? Just listen to some music and appreciate it. Like, we laugh off the music appreciation course as, like, a fluff nonsense thing. But there are things that either as a musician or as someone who's been taught about music, even if you're not especially actively making music, there is more to be heard in the very same performance than you noticed. To go beyond just, oh, that sounds nice, to understand things about how harmony works, how voices play together, counterpoint and dissonance, and, you know, understanding the history of music and the wider context into which certain figures or certain styles fit, and the things that have been done before that we're playing with or playing against or reacting against in various ways. All of those, there is, all of that was in the music already, and you had no idea until it was pointed out in a certain way, until you learned either through the music appreciation course, or better yet, by just, like, picking up an instrument and getting some instruction and learning to make music. There are all of these elements that were in a like laws of physics way, or in a laws of history way, or whatever else. All of these things were there already, but yet they were not a part of your experience until you got to a certain level of attainment. And so my generic answer to the film critic is that if film is like music, there are going to be things equivalent to that in the film world as there are in the music world. In a way that not, you know, someone who is herself a musician or an accomplished student of music in whatever way stands in a different respect to critiquing a musical performance than just some random person picked off the street, who is also going to have an opinion, who is also a human being with different, perhaps, kind of worth and dignity. But as a musician, they're not in a position to say something about music in the same way. And so it's that's a piece, I think, of this intelligibility, right? That there are things there to be discovered about music It's not simply whatever I on this day want it to be. And so, because of that, because there are things about music there to be discovered that are independent of me, that means that there are objective standards by which someone else can appreciate my excellence, can praise me as a musician, and not just as a generic human being, right? The way that the mother's like, oh, that was pat on the back, no matter what. You know, praising me perhaps as her son or as a generic human being, but not as a musician, not as an artist, macaroni necklace, right? Not as whatever else those things might be. If there were not those standards in some part of the world prior to me, and that priority is a metaphysical, philosophic priority. In fact, you know, musicians, you know, we're building up the body of standards as we go as a community together. We're discovering what good musicianship is together by reacting to the world, by responding to the world, right? If that were not there, there would be quite a lot of excellence that couldn't exist, right? If those standards were not there, then we'd be mired in this, it's whatever you want it to be, sort of relativism that Amber is always so bothered by, or so sensitive to, like, veering into it, which is always a good thing. Pretty much, yeah. like, we all have things that we're especially attentive to. And so, but that intelligibility somehow is a part of the, you get to know what the domain is. And maybe this will be the, I know we're just itching to move, but maybe the last piece, we can try to tie this together a little bit more at the third stop in various ways. There was this really interesting study done a number of years ago where they took a bunch of chess players of various abilities, and for just a couple of quick seconds, like, flashed on a screen a chessboard with a configuration of pieces, and then took it away, and then asked the person to recreate from memory as much of what they saw as they could. And so it turned out that, I forget the exact, like, amount of seconds that it was, but it was the same for everyone. But the chess grandmasters could remember, like, 20 or 25 pieces after this quick little glimpse. Someone who's, like, a moderately good chess player could get about 15. And people who were utter novices at chess could only remember about 5 or 6 piece locations. But then they did an interesting follow-up. They took the same group of people and showed them a random configuration of chess pieces that could never actually occur in the game of chess. Like, moves that just would never happen in a real chess game for very, like both bishops on black and not one each on black and white. Like, you can never have that, right? When they did those nonsense chess boards, everybody, even the grandmaster, could only remember 5 or 6 pieces. So that suggests to us, perhaps, that one of the things that the advanced chess player did was not just see the pieces, but see the circumstance, see an entire chess problem as a coherent whole, different than just an additive sum of parts. If all they were doing was remembering the bishop is here, the rook is here, the pawn is there, they should have done just as well on the nonsense boards as on the real boards, but they couldn't, right? So it suggests that a part of the mastery that goes into excellence at chess is learning to see whole environments or whole problems in a way that the uninitiated person can't yet, until he applies himself and becomes a good chess player. That might be happening in other kinds of situations in life, too. I think it is, right? I think that goes on in music or in art or in craft of various kinds. So that there's a learning to see in another way that's a part of this process toward excellence. And so that, too, is a piece of what I mean by this intelligibility. I no longer have just a chaos of data points. I have a pattern. I have an instance, I have a kind of problem space that I couldn't see, even though I could see the data. One of the biggest things that science education is about is not learning how to run the instruments and collect the data. A big part of science education, among other big parts, and I don't want to diminish the other parts, is learning how to ask a good experimental question. Which things count as good experimental setups and which things don't, right? When faced with an unexplained phenomenon, how to identify individual variables that can be tested in a laboratory setting or what have you, right? Learning what a scientific question, as opposed to other kinds of questions that are not under the umbrella of chemistry or of physics or of the sciences. Learning how to think like a scientist, right? Which itself is not rule following, I don't think.
Something that you had mentioned earlier about the, and I know we're getting ready to move to the next one, but you use the example of a sculptor sort of chipping away that the objective standards are within the marble itself. And I'm wondering.
In a little more than that.
Yeah. But something along those lines. I'm just wondering if this idea of being able to see something in its more coherent form might be pointing to, pointing us towards sort of this larger, the form of the marble is a sort of deeper kind of. I don't know what exactly that I'm getting at, with the exception of there's something having to do with this thing that we're aiming
at. Yeah,
coherent
and thing in Borgman's robust sense.
Yeah. A what?
Thing in Albert Borgman's robust sense of thing. Yeah. Not just like a whatever.
Right.
Right, but a thing that comes with a telos, comes with a nature, comes with a... Not just what it is, but what it can be.
And that, I think, ties into the responsibilities component, too.
Yes.
You're able to see that telos, what naturally follows from that, that's required of me to give brain or blame or otherwise.
Yeah. In psychology, they talk about affordances to things. Is that that's a new word to a lot of people? So for instance, I mentioned those Welsh chair makers, right? I walk through a woodland, even there in Wales, and I see a bunch of trees. The chair maker sees the trees, but he also sees arms for a chair, backs and rails for a chair. He sees something that is able to be that I don't see, even though we're looking at the same tree, because he's the accomplished chair maker and I'm not. I might see other things, right? I see certain trees here, and I see resin that makes a beautiful, fragrant, aromatic incense that others don't when they look at that. Or I see the medicinal affordances that tree might offer for me in various ways. This is another way of seeing more than just like what's going to be captured in a photograph in like pixels and dots. It's seeing what's possible with this thing, right? So I see a piece of marble if I'm a good sculptor, which I'm not. A good sculptor sees a block of marble, sees the way the veins are running through the stone, sees that, oh, you could carve this out and allow this shape to emerge, whereas other opportunities wouldn't be possible, right? You need the arm to not like fall off by being unsupported because the grain is wrong or whatever, right? As one is carving wood, grain matters in some immense ways, like long grain, short grain, what have you. You see not just a hunk of marble, but you see what that marble is able to be, right? You see the possibilities that were in that marble all along, but that others who may have looked at it may never have seen because they weren't sculptors. They weren't attending in the right sort of way. Those affordances are, in general, the possibilities for action that are given or provided or afforded to us by the things in our environment because of what and how those things are. So we get new affordances. We get new opportunities for action as we advance in these ways. So it's not just descriptive knowledge. It's not just propositional knowledge. It's not just a body of facts. It's seeing the world in terms of opportunities for action. that needn't be instrumentalizing. Right? I have many friends in my life, thankfully. I'm not that much of a loner, right? I know that together with different friends, there are different things that are possible for us to do together. I'm not using my friend as a tool. I just know that Marisa is a certain way, and so certain kinds of activities can emerge from our time together. Whereas Amber is a different way, and different kinds of activities can emerge from our time together, and so on. That's coming to know Marisa differently from Amber, differently from dot, 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 right? As who they are. Seeing them more fully, I think. Affordances, anyway. We can think about that and meander as we walk and see what we can do with this.